I'm going to talk about some of my favorite people today. Over the weekend, I was at a memorial service and a conference in honor of my late mentor, the great historian and sociologist Charles Tilly. And when I first knew him, which was a long time ago, he was working on collective violence. He's someone in his career who published literally 51 books, over 600 articles, but above all was a generous mentor to a whole bunch of people, including yours truly. But he was working on collective violence, and he once told me, in fact, I couldn't find exactly where he wrote this, if he did. He once told me, and I mentioned this the first day, but that it's bitter hard to write the history of remainders. And so some of the people that I'm going to talk about today didn't see themselves as remainders in history, but they're people who didn't quite fit in and were really overwhelmed and ultimately defeated by the economic and social and political processes. And if one of the themes of this course, and of any course really, I suppose, and it deals with the modern world experience, even especially in these days of globalization, is that dynamic duo of capitalism or large-scale economic change and the state, you're going to see that today in some of the folks that I'm talking about. And I once used the example of trying to get you to imagine, you know, parachuting over the European continent over a very slow descent. And let's say now from maybe, mid-16th century until mid-19th century. And if you could see every incident of collective violence, of political protest, popular protest that occurred, and all protest is ultimately a political, by far the most prevalent would have been the grain riot. And this itself is terribly significant, and so is its disappearance, given what I've just said about the state and large-scale economic change. Another way to imagine this is if you had a Richter scale that moved or that registered every incident of collective violence. And Tilly and his whole team were counting up every single incident of collective violence that they could find in Europe between really mid-18th century in terms of his study, or even earlier than that, in 1936, and would come to the same conclusion that you would were you floating over this great continent for that period of time. And so what I'm going to do today is sort of a trilogy, talk about three things. First, grain riots, and they're all related. Second, the swing movement, Captain Swing, drawing on the book, a classic book a long time ago of Eric Hobsbawm and George Roudet, two truly great historians, along with Tilly. And third, talk about something that I did, talk about the demoiselle of the Ariège, and I'll make that clear in a while. But all three fit together, I think, very nicely. And one of the underlying themes, which you'll see, is that popular protest and collective violence attached to popular protest is not random can be spontaneous, but it's not illogical, that there's a logic to popular protest right through the ages, in the early modern period as well as in the 19th century, and that ordinary people put forth their demands by protesting, and in doing so hope to affect change, to appeal to authorities who hopefully will do the right thing, and often imagine a world in the past where a sense of justice prevailed. And in terms of grain riots, I'll talk about the just price, because they talked about it. So having said that, let me enter the world of grain riots. Give you some examples. This is from Spain, 1856. With the pretext of the high price of bread and for lack of work, The workers of Valladolid and Burgos rose and burned flour stores, mills, and inspection offices. The civil governor intervened to put down the rising, but the rebels overwhelmed him and attacked the chiefs of his forces. The sacking and burning continued. Most likely as a consequence of the spreading of news of the incident, disturbances also spread to the countryside and to other cities. The governor of Palencia tried to hold back the uprising in his city, but he had to retreat before a hissing crowd. In Benavente, Rio Seco, and along the canal, the disorders reoccurred. They had the characteristics of the old type of rebellion aimed at spectators and hoarders, among whom the masters of workshops were counted. In their hatred, the insurgents set fire to shops and storehouses with the cry of cheap bread, and attacked the boats that served for the transport of grain, as well as putting the torch to grain not yet harvested in the fields. If you back up almost a century ago, in France, if you look at the memoirs of a royal official, if from May 3rd in 1775, the musketeers who had been warned the day before hurried to the markets. The fleeing rioters overturned baskets full of bread and blocked the way to the horses. It was 9 a.m. The watch was supposed to be getting its orders at that hour, and the people had already gone to the bakers and seized the bread they found in the shops. That pillage had a special character. People did it without violence. The shops of the bakers were emptied, and those of the pastry makers and the dealers in other foods, which were equally exposed, were left untouched. Or 1816 in England, East Anglia. In early summer, surprise came that the agricultural laborers, who we'll come back to hear about in a little while, of East Anglia had come out in revolt. Conditions had worsened since the end of the Napoleonic War, and riots and disturbances were everywhere in the towns. The point is that I could give you examples from virtually every country over a very long period of time, and the grain riot would dominate. Now, if you take this is France based, but it's true of almost everywhere. And again, do not write this down. Men fight for food in the following years, particularly. They come in waves: 1693, 94, 98, 1709, 10, 1728, 1739, 40, 49, 52, 68, 70, 1775, big one, 1785, 1788, 89. 93, 99, 1811, 1812, 1816, 1817, 1829, 1830, 1839, 40, 1846, 47, 1853, 54, and then never again. By never again, I mean in France, never again, and slowly the grain riot disappears as a form of political protest, of collective violence or collective nonviolence, depending on the case. And so that's the big question, is, you know, what's going on here? You know, popular protest is a way of finding out what's going on when you look at all this stuff. And why do the grain riots disappear as a form of collective violence? Why? Here's a placard that is a poster scrawled in the town of Baville in the west of France in 1709. We are dying of hunger. We must absolutely order you to set prices on bread and grain, or else we will break from our homes like enraged lions, weapons in one hand, fire in the other. Arson, fire, by the way, is one of those what my friend Jim Scott at Yale calls weapons of the weak. Just a match to a harvest or to a roof, a chaumière of a thatched cottage can do some serious mischief. But what they want to do, these grain rioters, very ordinary people, men and particularly women. Remember, women are responsible for the household economy, and also young people and also children. What they want to do is they're putting forth claims. They want the governments, the monarchies, the administrators, the officials, the intendants, the governors, the sheriffs in England, to set the price of bread, as Maximilien Robespierre and the Jacobins had wanted them to. Why? To set the price of bread. To keep the price of bread low, so that everybody would have access to buying bread. Now, bread represents bread, literally, that commodity, whether dark bread in the poorer regions of Central Europe, or in the south of France, or in parts of Spain and southern Italy, or white bread, which is more associated with more prosperous peasants, represented more than half of the expenses of ordinary people, not just food, but bread. So bread is what people ate. Black bread were the poorer areas, white bread the wealthier areas, to make a generalization. There were all different kinds of bread. Here's how I can approach this. In the town of Liège, which is in Wallonia, that is in now what's now eastern Belgium, Liège, famous for its cork, among other things, and now part of the Rust Belt of eastern Belgium, they had a municipal statute, that is a municipal regulation, from about the 14th century. The date 1317 sticks in my mind somewhere. I must have read that decades ago. And it said that on market day, that merchants would not be allowed, from other places, would not be allowed in to buy grain until the third day of the market. And by the way, the term for merchants they used were engrosseurs, which has a sense in French of people who would make themselves fat, engrosseurs. Why? Because they could afford to buy bread at the price that nobody else could afford. And they wouldn't be allowed in until the third day of the market. But of course, that's not what happens through most of European history. And so the pressure from these crowds, the logic of these crowds, is to force municipal authorities in the name of order, but perhaps, who knows, in the name of justice, to set a price of bread so that everybody could have a shot at it. Now, as some wag once put, criticizing this kind of social history, well, it's pretty obvious that grain riots occur on market days in areas in which there is grain being exported out of a region. But that is precisely the point. And so the peasants don't, or townspeople, don't riot. Ordinary people don't riot necessarily when the price of grain reaches its absolute maximum. But when they riot is they seize grain or they pillage shops at the moment when, particularly when they see grain being taken out of the community, removed from their sense of moral authority over something upon which they depend to live. And so women, as I said before, play the major role in grain riots. Why? Because they're responsible for the household economy. And so right through this whole period, there's a familiar scenario. People pour into town for market day. They see the stagecoaches, the diligences, the wagons, carting the grain away, and they stop it. They stop it. And it's the same format everywhere as if you had some sort of internet or CNN or something like that telling people, here's how you grain riot. But they don't rip off the grain, and they don't rip off, as the one example I gave you, fancy pastries and stuff like that. They take the grain, often to a communal piece of property, such as the commons, or a municipal, the shed, the covered market. I mean, some of the most fantastic examples, are in the south of France, but all sorts of places too. And they sell the grain to ordinary people at what they consider to be the just price. And they use that expression, the just price. And there's a sense of moral outrage that some forces they can't control are taking away what they need to survive. 1789, a year what's the big collective action in Paris? It's the seizing of the Bastille, of course, but above all, it's the attack on the customs barriers, the tax offices that ring Paris, which force the price of food, grain, bread, everything up higher. They attack them as a symbol of what they consider to be an unfair economy that's depriving them of the right to have enough to eat. Now, so these, but these wagons, you know, that are carrying grain away, who's in these wagons? Who are these folks and what are they doing? Well, they're merchants, and they know that if they can take, when they're buying up grain, where are they taking the grain? They're taking it to Berlin, or they're taking it to Stuttgart, or they're taking it to Munich, or to Milan, or to Paris, or Lyon. Why? Because that grain will command even a higher price there when you've got all these people. And what is the interest of monarchies and other forms of tyranny, if you will? It's their interest is to feed the cities first. And so the growth of cities, the growth of bureaucracies of the state, the growth of garrisons who have to be fed, increases the pressure on grain in times of harvest failure. And grain riots, you know, not only are the timing is, you know, markets when grain is leaving the town, but of course, obviously, the subtext is that at times of these cyclical harvest failures, the harvest fails, credit is withdrawn, the price of bread goes up, and the riots start. And if you look at where the riots start in any of these countries that I've talked about, it's in response to these to grain being taken out of rural regions and being taken to cities to get higher prices. So you got the merchant on the wagon too, and you probably got his driver. But who else do you have there increasingly? Well, you've got the Guardia Civila in Spain. Or you've got the various police in the Italian states, or you've got the tough, hardened Berlin police, or the Prussian army, or you've got the gendarmes, or the maréchaussée as they called them in the 18th century, or the gendarmes in the 19th century. So here again, here's a way of looking at this theme of the state and capitalism are on the wagon here. You've got the merchant, and you've got the police guarding him. That's the dynamic duel of change over the long run. So, you know, to be sure, people who have big plots of land in Pomerania or in northern Italy or in the Bus, the south of Paris, around Chartres or someplace like that, these are big, these people are not out grain rioting. What are they doing? They're hoarding. They're waiting till the price of grain even goes higher, and that's why form of a popular protest, of collective action, and all throughout this whole period are attacks on hoarders. 1789, you read about it in the book, the famine plot. The idea that somehow, that wealthy aristocrats are trying to starve out the poor to get their way, and that hoarders have a huge, sacks of grain, which they often did, in their chateaus. And that they're holding it from the market, and laissez-faire says, let the market decide the price. Well, okay, let's keep that stuff back. People go hungry, too damn bad for them. They should have more money. Over and over and over again in all of these places, the grain riot is the most important form of collective violence, of popular protest. And then it just disappears. Again, France is the most studied, but it disappears earlier in Britain. You'll know why already. You already know. I'll tell you again in a minute. Ain't no peasants left in Britain. But in France, the last wave is 1855. Now, there are protests at the end of the 19th century against the high cost of food. These are, one shouldn't imagine people, surrounding the Stop and Shop with blocking it with their little push carts that they're putting their frozen food into, but they're the equivalents of that. I mean, there are protests against the high cost of food, and food still is an important dynamic in protest. In World War II, for example, irritation about the rich doing even better than ever, and rationing cards and all that business. But the grain riot simply disappears as a form of popular protest in Europe. Period. It doesn't mean that bread wouldn't be terribly important in the Russian Revolution. It does, and there are there are riots in Russia, against the high price of bread. But the classic from Western Europe beginning in Western Europe and moving east, the classic, just the quintessentially popular domain of protest, expression of popular protest, just disappears. Period. Point. Why? The battle's been won. The merchants, the police, the gendarmes, the troops, they're already there. And in beginning again west to Eastern Europe, you've got the depopulation of marginal rural property, marginal rural lands. People can't make it anymore, producing little bits of this and that, and they plunge themselves into the new urban, emerging urban, not new, but ever increasing urban world in order to find work. And so if you look at what people protest over, we can see that, you know, you can see this big economic change. I mean, the 19th century just transforms the way people live. This is for sure. The 19th century didn't invent consumer culture. We already know Jan de Vries has just published within the last month or two, a brilliant book about showing that ordinary families made all sorts of sacrifices to try to improve their lives beginning in the middle of the 17th century, participating in this consumer culture, buying soap, buying forks, and that kind of thing. But these big time economic changes, the 19th century is really is the crucial period in the whole thing. And the disappearance of the grain riot as a form of popular protest is just a fantastic demonstration of that fact. You know, you don't want to complicate the thing or really undermine the validity of what I've said by imagining, say, well, that's all pre-modern, this kind of protest, and we got sort of modern protest, and more strikes and all that. It's true that there are more strikes, and strikes become another sort of classic form of political protest, but the world of the 19th century was changing, and the big losers in all of this, of course, are rural people, rural laborers, peasants who simply couldn't make a go and their world is transformed. That's part one of this trilogy. Secondly, now let's look at the swing movement. These next two things I'm going to talk about, take place really at the same time. And that's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence at all. The first story is that of Captain Swing. I alluded to this the very first day, those of you who are here, was 1829, really, 1830. Those are the big years. And then the Demoiselles of the Ariège comes at just the same time. They're similar, fascinating. I think they're fascinating. I hope you will, too. And they have so much in common with each other and what I've just been talking about. It's not about winners and losers in the brave new economy of high-powered capitalism in all its incarnations in Europe, big and small. But we see the faces, the remainders of this kind of economic change. And again, this is the people who worked on Captain Swing were George Roudet and Eric Hobsbawm. How to put this? There was a real person called Ned Ludd in about 1816, 1817, in there, in England. Ludd, the word English word Luddite, is someone who's a machine breaker. Luddism is machine breaking. You break machines because machines are putting you out of work. You're a hand loom weaver. Famous cases in Silesia in Germany. And then machines, or glassworks, and later in the century, things I talked about last time are putting them out of work. And Ned Ludd busted up machines. He broke machines. 1829, awful economic year everywhere in Europe. Freezing winter, hunger, real hunger in Britain. That's my example. From Britain, from England specifically, from the south of England even more specifically. They found people who were starved to death in the fields with only dandelions in their stomachs with nothing else to eat. If you were a Frenchman or a German or an Italian, say a northern Italian, and you went to England in 1829 or 1830. If you did the reverse of the Arthur Young track, Arthur Young was always wandering through France and discovering people he thought were 65 or 70. Turned out they were 29. They were so battered and beaten down by hardship. The famous case of a woman he met in Champagne near Reims of that case. Arthur Young saw all of these peasants in Europe. But the counterpart of Arthur Young, people from the continent going to England, were amazed. There weren't any more peasants. Virtually no peasants. If you define a peasant as a small property owner, existentially committed to the land, that's a little bit overly fancy, but dependent upon a small piece of land, a lopin de terre, a piece of land for family survival, the household economy, there weren't any more peasants left in England. What there were you had gentry, you had big property owners who were masters of all that they saw before them in the portraits they had painted of themselves. You had gentry, you had yeomen who were sort of smaller versions of gentry. You had property owners, sort of middle rank property owners and this sort of thing. You had wealthy people from the city buying, wanting to live in an aristocratic way, buying as much land as they could take. There was no place in Europe in which such a small percentage of the population owned so much of the land. That's still true today. In Britain, still true today. But there weren't any peasants. Why? Because the big fish had eaten the smaller fish, and because, beginning in the 16th century, the enclosure movement, which you've read about, I think, the enclosure movement meant that basically, no surprise, the big guys get the law on their side. Parliament passes thousands of acts of enclosure, which allow people to enclose and divide up the common land. And the big fish eat the smaller fish, and the peasantry is basically destroyed. And so what you have, as I said before in another context, in England, you've got all sorts of textile workers, you've got all sorts of governesses and domestic workers, and you have hundreds of thousands, millions of agricultural laborers. You have agricultural laborers in other countries too, but you also have small property owners. Hardly any of those folks left in England. So to return to the story, in 1829, ordinary people start participating in protest and collective action. And they start threatening and indeed smashing and burning threshing machines. Why threshing machines? Because threshing machines are taking their work. The way they survive is during harvest, they go from place to place working, the way people still do in the wine harvest in south of France. Working from place to place, bringing in the harvest, prosperous agricultural land in the south of England. This is how they get by. They don't live very well. They don't do very well, but they're lodged, they're fed. They have a crummy place to sleep, but they can do okay. But then the big guys, the big farmers, they start buying threshing machines. So the threshing machines do the work of these people. So next time the guys come along, you know, in groups of 10, 20, 30, families, pals, friends, they come around and say, well, look, you know, it's harvest time. Here we are. Nous voilà. Sorry, old chap. We don't need you. Maybe a couple of you, but we don't need you. We got these machines. They do the job that used to do. We don't have a problem with them working hard all the time. The machines work all the time at our command. See ya. Are they mad? They're furious. And they start burning these machines. They start smashing down the gates and going in and burning these machines. And then they started to find posters that had been written, scrawled posters, sometimes barely literate because this wasn't a literate population. And they begin to talk about a mythical-like figure like Ned Ludd, except this wasn't a real one. And my favorite, I had this former girlfriend a long time ago at Mighty Michigan, and we were going to write a screenplay about this. We never did. One of them said, they all said, like, if you don't get rid of the threshing machine, your agony will begin. We will destroy your machines. We will burn you out. But the best that I ever saw was, revenge for thee is on the wing. from thy determined Captain Swing. Who was Captain Swing? He was a sense of popular justice. He was what used to be called the moral economy. He did not exist. He should have. He still should exist. He did not exist. But Captain Swing gave this kind of paramilitary sense to, we are many, we are correct, we are right, we have God on our side, we are organized, and we will win. The subtext is that maybe we better negotiate and see. Maybe you keep a few machines around, but we want our jobs back. So Captain Swing, he was everywhere. He was in Kent, he was in Cambridgeshire, he was in Devon, he was in Wiltshire. He didn't exist, but he was everywhere, at least in the popular imagination. By the way, the Captain Swing folks had some allies, and they were the smaller farmers who couldn't afford the big-time threshing machines, and they thought, well, you know, maybe if they burn the machines of my ravenous neighbor, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. So they get a little kind of moral support from folks like that, and they spread, and they're in all sorts of places. Do they win? Are you kidding? They lose. The sheriff comes, and in a country that only had a police force starting in 1829 in London, that didn't like the idea of uniformed armies. That was something the French and the Spanish had. They bring their military contingents, and they beat the hell out of these people. And they put them on trial. They hang some of them. Not all that many. They send lots of them to where? To Tasmania. That's where they sent them, or to Australia. We all live in a convict colony, as they say, sometimes sing in Australia, whenever they play the palms, as they call the British. They send them a long, long way, and they defeat them. It's bitter hard to write the history of remainders. It's fun, though, too. It's fun. Captain Swing disappears. The big guys win. Enclosure keeps rolling along. Tens of thousands of people are on the road. Oh, they get a little victory. The poor law of 1832 was probably influenced by this threat, this perceived threat of popular people voting with their feet, threatening but also negotiating, cajoling, trying to imagine a time in the past when everybody had a shot at doing well enough. Same thing as the grain riots. Imagining a time when there was a just price for everything. Captain Swing was really part of that. I find what they did thrilling, but I probably shouldn't say that. And of course, they probably had a lot of time to think about what they did on that extraordinarily long trip to Port Arthur. Not the Port Arthur in Asia, but the Port Arthur in Tasmania, or to what would become New South Wales or Victoria in Australia. But Captain Swing disappeared. He never existed, but he sure should have. Now, a long time ago, when I was starting out, I was working in the archives in Vincennes. In Paris, or on the edge of Paris, the military archives there in the big Chateau de Vincennes, and I was working on other stuff, and I kept finding these incidents that were occurring at precisely the same time as Captain Swing, 1829, 1830, not in England, but in France, and I kept finding these reports to imagine La Belle France. There we go. Nice, huh? Mountains. Perpignan. Toulouse here. Bordeaux up here. Voila. I kept finding in a department called the Ariège, mountainous department I kept finding these reports. The capital of it is Foix, but that's in the plain, kind of. And then you go up into the mountains, and you got real serious mountains. And now people drive through those mountains to get to Andorra to buy cheaper pastis and cigarettes and that kind of thing. But it is very, very beautiful there. It's full also now of people from 1968 who went off and formed communes in the Ariège. And sometimes you see some of them staggering around there. But I kept finding reports from the police. Or from the gendarme, above all, or from mayors, saying that men dressed as women were coming down the mountain in the mists and the fog and the snow, armed with pitchforks, armed with rifles, and were chasing away two groups of people, charbonniers, who are charcoal burners, forest people, cutting down trees, and forest guards, those people guarding the forests, employed by the state, employed by the rural bourgeoisie, or people living in Foix or Toulouse who owned a lot of land in the forests, or by communes, if it's forests were communally owned, to try to keep out ordinary people. And these people were coming down the mountain and taking shots at them and yelling nasty things to them, threatening them with pitchforks, and tried to drive them away. And then they would find notes saying, if the forest guards and the charcoal burners come back, your agony will begin. Signed, Jean, Lieutenant of the Demoiselle. A demoiselle in French is obviously, you know, a young woman, demoiselle. And these became known as the demoiselles of the Ariège. So I found so many of these in 1829, 1830, 1831, a few in 1848, a couple in 1872, and never again, never again. Who were these people and what were they doing? What they wanted, again, think of Captain Swing, think of the grain riots. What they wanted was access to the forests. They'd always had access to the forests. It's cold in the Ariège. You need wood that's gleaned from the forest to make fires to stay alive. You need berries, roots to eat. You need places to pasture your animals, pigs, which you know eat right down through the root, goats, like we have in our village in the south, in Ardèche. Or sheep, if they're really rich, maybe cows, but that didn't happen very much there. The rich guys owned the cows, the peasants didn't own the cows. They'd always, for centuries, as they well remembered, had access to the forest. Why did they lose access to the forest? They're looking back at an imaginary time, and it wasn't imaginary, they always had access. There was lots of forest. The whole place, deforestation is a big problem in France since the 17th, 18th century. But the Pyrenees have many forests, many mountains. They'd always been able to go there as they wanted. They didn't own the forest, but use and property were not categories that meant anything to anyone. And they're told they can't go there anymore. So some of them go to churches and they're looking for deeds that would have given their village, people of those villages, rights to be in the forest centuries ago. No, they don't find them. So why can't they go to the forest anymore to pasture their miserable animals or to find something to eat or some fuel? Why can't they do that anymore? Aha! Talking capitalism in the state. The price of wood has increased. Why? The metallurgical industry. What they call Catalan, as in Catalonia, forges, F-O-R-G-E-S, forges, small metallurgical industries, the price of wood goes up. So suddenly the people that own the forest say, hey baby, we don't want those peasants and their animals in the forest anymore. So they start hiring forest guards. They start hiring charcoal burners, charbonniers, who are chopping down the trees, slicing them up, as people still do in the Jura, or still do in the Black Forest, or do anywhere that you can think of in Europe, or in my Oregon, where I'm from, and logging was a good way to make money. I never did it, but when you're in college, and so the wood is leaving the forest. The people are getting even richer, and the peasants are out of luck. Why are they out of luck? Because what the big money people do that own the forest is they do exactly what the wealthy did in England, the big landowners. They get the law on their side. What a surprise. They have their lobbyists. They get the law on their side. They pass a new forest code in 1827 that keeps basically ordinary people out of the forests to which they had always had access. They'd always had access. They can't go there anymore. They go up there and they find guards there, armed guards. But they are many, and the guards are few, and they scare the hell out of them, and they drive them away. They drive them away. And the mayors of these little villages, Massah was one, I love to go places I've written about it, Massah was one, and the mayor, he's in a difficult position. He knows damn well who is causing the troubles, les troubles, in the forest, but he's got to live with these people. So he isn't going to be telling on anybody. So I followed this through, I read this, and wrote something about it in a book I did a long time ago called 1830 in France, edited book. So what happens? Who is Jean, lieutenant of the demoiselle, Jeanne? Who is she? Well, she didn't exist either. She's exactly like Captain Swing. She says, we are many, we are right, we have justice on our side. By the way, these people did not speak French. So it was hard for them to find somebody to write in French, your agony will begin, because they don't speak French. They spoke a patois that's very much influenced by Spanish, that's not even really like Catalan, or certainly nothing to do with Basque, which doesn't have anything to do with anything except vaguely Hungarian and Finnish. And so they write these things, and they say that Jean, the lieutenant of the demoiselle, will toast you one day if you don't leave the forest. And what they want, of course, is they want the government to restore their rights in the forest. Does the government do that? Are you kidding? Of course they don't. Now, 1830 comes along, revolution, liberty, fraternity, equality, red, white, and blue. So what do? They say, well, what's this liberty must mean that we can have our forest back, doesn't it? So but one of the interesting things about this is they become petitioners just for a little bit. They get people who can write French to petition saying, gee, we hear about this liberty in Paris, and that surely is our forest, isn't it? Uh-uh. The government says, oh, no, the forest code of 1827 is evermore in use, and you can't have access to the forest. And the forest guards return. The forest guards return to the forest, but so do the demoiselles. And they begin to dress up as women again. They lose. What a surprise. They're driven away. But why do they dress up as women? Well, one thing, a disguise. One thing they do, by the way, they, as sort of mocking the charcoal workers also, they put charcoal on their face. And they wear sheets. They try to make them look like dresses. Why as women? It's more than a disguise. What it is an enraged carnival. If you think of carnival, think of Mardi Gras in Europe, anywhere in Christian Europe. What you do during carnival, look at the floats in New Orleans, when everybody's getting wasted and dressing up in various things. The old version of that was that you dressed up like your exploiters. You could, the 3 days or 4 days, you could mock the judge who handed out unfair sentences. You could mock the big fat noble who had seigneurial rights over you. You could mock the gendarme who treated you badly. You could pretend it was a carnival, but an enraged carnival. During carnival, you stand the world on its head. And what you did in this case is you dressed up as women, reversing reality from their point of view. And this enraged carnival is intended, rather like the charivari, the chivalry, you call it in English, in which you pound on pots and pans outside the house of a couple or a woman, for example, who's married somebody from another village. You try to set things right again by pounding on, calling attention to a misdeed that's violated the communal sense of justice. And that's what these people are doing. They're saying, respect us, respect justice. And so they're dressing up like women. They're standing the world on its head. And it's an enraged, deadly, serious carnival. You know, they'll shoot at these people and, you know, beat the hell out of them when they catch them. And so that's what so Jean, the lieutenant of the demoiselle, represents justice and this kind of acting out of this enraged carnival. So it's more than a disguise. But they don't win. Captain Swing doesn't win either. They're arrested. They're put on trial. Some of them are put in the slammer, in jail. But they in the end, you know, they come back in 1830, end of 1830, 1831, some in 1832, if I remember right. 1848, they're back. 1872, but then never again. And the Ariège as a department depopulates rapidly in the second half of the 19th century. These people can't make it in the forest anymore. They can't go into the forest anymore. They can't survive with their little plots of land. And so they bail out, they get out. And their great, great, great grandchildren, many of them work in the Aérospatiale, in the, you know, the aircraft factories in Toulouse, or go to Bordeaux, or go to Paris, or end up go to Agen, or end up somewhere else. So the demoiselle, like Captain Swing, like these grain rioters in all of these countries, in Spain, in Britain, in Prussia, everywhere, these are the remnants of what people viewed as a traditional way of doing things that at least was infused with a sense of the proper, a sense of popular justice. And the demoiselle tried to stand carnival on its, the world on its head during carnival and try to get people to do the right thing, to return the forests to them, return the threshing machines, get the threshing machines the hell out of the big farms in Kent and other places, restore grain and bread to a reasonable price so everybody could have a shot at buying some. But in the end, they lose out to this dynamic duo, more powerful duo, the state and capitalism. It's bitter hard to write the history of remainders.